Water fluoridation remains controversial even after 8 decades. Last week, we heard the pros. Today, we get the cons. This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Today's guest is a physician scientist who has studied how chemicals like lead affect children's brain development.
His research suggests that exposure to fluoridated water may have a negative impact on some children's IQ. A new meta-analysis supports that finding.
How can we make sense of conflicting information about exposure to fluoride? Why have regulators in the U.S. considered chemicals safe until proven hazardous?
Coming up on the People's Pharmacy, learning about the downsides of water fluoridation.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, usually the flu season begins to subside by February. Not this year. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say that influenza infections are at the highest rate in 15 years and still rising. The flu season peaked right around the beginning of January, but instead of fading away, it's rising again now. About 8% of emergency department visits are attributable to influenza. In addition, many people who had the flu back in January are now showing up with complications such as bacterial pneumonia. According to the CDC, there have been about 24 million cases of influenza so far this winter. Some school systems have had to shut down for several days, and an estimated 13,000 people have died. One bit of good news is that COVID-19, while still causing infections, is not at a peak. The COVID peak late last summer may have left many people with some immunity. Or perhaps the flu is crowding COVID out for now.
Bird flu, also known as H5N1 avian influenza, is responsible for high egg prices. That's because many poultry flocks have been culled over the last few months. Last week, the Department of Agriculture reported a new strain of bird flu, D1.1, among dairy cattle in Nevada. This variant has been circulating among wild birds and has crossed over to chickens. The person who died from bird flu in Louisiana apparently contracted D1.1. A dairy worker in Nevada has just been diagnosed with H5N1, and it has also been identified as the D1.1 variant. Public health authorities continue to monitor such human cases carefully in case this new variant becomes readily transmissible.
You may have been warned to reduce your salt intake because high sodium consumption is linked to hypertension. Now, a large controlled trial published in JAMA Cardiology has confirmed that using a salt substitute containing potassium can lower the risk of a stroke. The researchers studied more than 15,000 individuals who had experienced a stroke. They participated in a study of 600 villages in northern China that were supplied with ordinary table salt or a salt substitute that was partly sodium chloride and partly potassium chloride. The mixture tastes like table salt. Investigators followed the volunteers for 5 years and collected data on strokes and death. Those consuming the salt substitute were 14% less likely to have a recurrent stroke. They were also 12% less likely to die from a stroke. This is significant because people who've had one stroke are at higher risk for a subsequent one. An editorial in the same issue of the journal points out that it's practical for these volunteers to lower their sodium intake with a salt substitute, as the majority of their food is cooked at home. Another study, also published in that issue, examined the impact of regulations in South Africa. Legislation reducing the sodium content of processed foods also lowered sodium consumption and rates of hypertension. The editorialists note that both studies provide evidence of benefit and safety.
Birth control pills have been associated with an increased risk of blood clots, particularly in the large veins in the legs. This is called venous thromboembolism, and it can be dangerous as well as painful. Over the last few decades, doses of estrogen and progestin have dropped, and Danish researchers wondered if modern contraceptives are still associated with an increased risk for clotting. To find out, they analyzed the Danish National Registers to study healthy females between 15 and 49. Rates for people not using hormonal contraceptives were about 2 in 10,000 person years. Females taking combined estrogen and progestin pills had a rate of 10 per 10,000. The investigators conclude, quote, "Variation in VTE risk across products underscores the importance of personalized contraceptive counseling." And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. Last week, we began a two-part series on fluoride in water. For the most part, we focused on the benefits rather than any risks. But water fluoridation remains a controversial topic, even though it's been used in the U.S. since 1945.
This week, we'll be examining some of the potential problems that may be associated with fluoride exposure.
But first, we will recap our conversation last week with Dr. Gary Slade. He is the John W. Stamm Distinguished Professor of Dentistry at the University of North Carolina Adams School of Dentistry in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Here's just a bit of what he had to say.
My perspective is that the benefits in preventing decay are clear and abundant, and that it's a good thing for children to have fluoridated water, to be using fluoridated toothpaste in the right amounts. I think it's important, recognizing the controversies that we're most recently seeing with IQ, and there have been others before that, I want to remain vigilant. I believe all reputable researchers want to remain vigilant and continue to really chase down what is happening with this new evidence. And even the authors of some of those initial papers questioning, is there an adverse effect on IQ? I think they are looking on and saying, well, we still need more evidence. The question isn't answered yet.
That was Dr. Gary Slade. He is the John W. Stamm Distinguished Professor of Dentistry at the UNC Adams School of Dentistry in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. He was our featured guest on last week's show about the pros and cons of water fluoridation.
We turn now to Dr. Bruce Lanphier, Professor of Health Sciences at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. He studied the effects of lead exposure on children's health for decades. More recently, he's published research on the effects of early fluoride exposure on children's IQ.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Bruce Lanphier.
It's good to be with you.
Dr. Lanphier, you have studied a range of neurotoxins, from lead and mercury to pesticides and even PFAS chemicals. How in the world did you get interested in fluoride?
Well, I got roped in. I felt some obligation about 20 years ago. Somebody asked me when I was doing a lecture at Dartmouth College what I thought about water fluoridation. And I said, well, I haven't really studied it, but one of the most important roles of government is to examine potential threats. And so that led me to feel obligated 15 years later when I was asked if I would help do studies on fluoride to agree.
You've just described that you felt obligated to look into the effects of fluoride when you were asked to do so. What did you find?
Well, it was a series of studies that we did, first to try to understand the extent of water exposure that people have that were in our birth cohort. And then we started to look at the amount of fluoride in mother's urine. We were particularly concerned about the developing fetus, the developing brain. And so we collected and measured fluoride in mother's urine three times during pregnancy, and we found that as the levels of fluoride increased, we saw a significant reduction in the IQ scores of their children. But when we looked at urine, it was only in the boys. When we looked at water, it was in both boys and girls, because we were able to find out the concentration of fluoride in their drinking water.
That seems confusing.
Well, not really. We see sex differences quite often when we study neurotoxic chemicals like lead. And so we weren't at all surprised. In fact, we set that question up a priori before we even began doing this study. So that's not unusual. Boys and girls are different.
And just out of curiosity, when you say an IQ difference, I mean, how long did you track these kids?
Well, the first time we did the analysis was when the children were 3 to 4 years of age. So they were recruited when the mother was pregnant, typically around 10 weeks gestation. And then we followed them. They're continuing to be followed now, but for the purpose of this study, we did an IQ assessment and at 3 to 4 years of age.
And you discovered that the kids who were exposed to fluoride had a lower IQ? And was there a dose response curve?
Yes, there was a dose response curve. It appears to be a linear dose response curve. And that is important because we don't expect, for example, that all of a sudden when you get down to this low level or that low level, that it's going to disappear. In fact, for most neurotoxicants, we don't find any evidence of a safe level or threshold, despite the fact that we've been operating, our regulatory agencies have been operating from this idea that there are safe levels or thresholds for non-carcinogens.
We had best explain what we mean when we say dose response curve. You know, pharmacologists love this terminology, but not everybody understands it. I would describe it as if you have one glass of wine, you might have just a tiny bit of impairment. If you have five glasses of wine, you would be substantially impaired. And if you drank 10 glasses of wine, you shouldn't drive. Can you give us the same sense of what you mean?
Well, that's exactly right. And for at least with fluoride, it looks proportional so that the amount of intoxication, if you will, from alcohol is linear, or it increases in a stepwise fashion. For other toxic chemicals like lead, we see what we call a decelerating dose response relationship, where the steepest decrement in IQ is at the lowest measurable levels. So there are different kinds, different shapes of dose response curves.
But the bottom line is that fluoride is not good for the developing fetus.
Well, that's what we found in our study. And some other studies showed the same thing. Some other studies didn't find that. And so that's why it's so important to have a way to synthesize all these studies and to come up with some way of understanding the totality of research.
Well, there's a new study out. Can you tell us what they found?
Yeah. So this was a study by Kyla Taylor and her team at the National Toxicology Program, or which is based at the National Environmental Health Institute. And what they found was, by looking at three types of meta-analysis, very consistent evidence that as fluoride levels increase, children's IQ scores decrease. Now, they did that three different ways. First, they used measures of dental fluorosis, water fluoride, and urinary fluoride, and showed that groups with higher exposures to fluoride, based upon those three measures, had lower IQ scores than children with lower fluoride exposures. Now, that's pretty crude, using that kind of a high versus low, but they showed inverse relationships with children's IQ scores. The second one was what they called a dose response meta-analysis. And for that, they looked at water fluoride and urinary fluoride separately. And they saw that down below levels of 2 parts per million of fluoride in drinking water, a statistically significant inverse relationship with children's IQ scores. For urinary fluoride, they saw statistically significant inverse relationships with IQ scores below 1.5. And that's important because we typically will find exposures in our communities, whether that's United States or Canada, between somewhere like 0.2 parts per million and 1.5 parts per million, or even somewhat higher.
So, Dr. Lanphier, what does this mean? I mean, is fluoride a neurotoxin in young kids, in the fetus? And what about for the rest of us, especially older people in their 80s and 90s who can't afford to lose any brain power?
Yeah, well, I would say at this stage, the evidence is not definitive, but I would also say that the evidence is sufficient to treat fluoride as a neurotoxicant. At this point, we can only say for the developing brain, for the developing fetus and children. That's what this study looked at. There hasn't been enough studies looking at adults with fluoride and cognitive abilities, but there are studies that have looked at fluoride exposure, particularly in older women, and found evidence that fluoride at higher exposures results in brittle bones, that they are more likely to have bone fractures. And that was based upon randomized controlled trials of fluoride supplementation, because it was thought that fluoride supplements increased bone mineral density and therefore reduced fractures. Fluoride does get into the bone. That's where it's stored for the most part. And it does appear to make the bones denser when you look at it with a DEXA scan. But in fact, it made them more brittle. So it's a different problem, but older people probably are not going to escape the problems of excess fluoride.
You're listening to Dr. Bruce Lanphier, professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. Dr. Lanphier's research at the intersection of preventive medicine, pediatrics, public health, toxicology, and infectious disease is driven by a commitment to prevent death, disease, and disability. Most recently, he has published research on the effects of early fluoride exposure on children's IQ. He's published over 350 peer-reviewed studies about the impact of toxic chemicals on intellectual deficits, behavioral problems, and brain structure in children.
After the break, Dr. Lanphier will describe a variety of ways that we're exposed to fluoride.
You've probably heard of PFAS. All of them contain fluoride as part of their chemical makeup.
How do we know if we're exposed to too much fluoride?
Why is fluoride still so controversial at this point in time?
Fluoride may interact with other compounds, such as iodine or lead. That makes tracking potential harms more difficult.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements, cocoflavanol supplements that support cognitive and cardiovascular health. made with a proven concentrated flavanol extract. More information at cocovia.com.
Today, we bring you the second of a two-part series on the pros and cons of fluoride. Last week, we focused on the potential benefits of water fluoridation. Today, we're looking at possible harms, especially for children.
Our guest is Dr. Bruce Lanfear. He's professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. His research is at the intersection of preventive medicine, pediatrics, public health, toxicology, and infectious disease.
So we have been talking about various ways that people are exposed to fluoride. We've really focused a lot on people drinking water, municipal water that has been deliberately fluoridated to prevent dental caries mostly. We've talked about women taking a supplement such as, for example, strontium fluoride to try to ward off osteoporosis. And you're saying it may have made the bones denser, but it didn't make them stronger. What other sources are people exposed to fluoride through?
Right. Well, first, let me just correct that last part. It made them look denser, but probably they were not denser.
Ah, okay.
So when we talk about the sources of fluoride, you're exactly right to target fluoride added to drinking water, because that is the major source. Probably somewhere between 40 to 70% of people's intake is from water. And if you're in a fluoridated community, it may be as high as 75%. So that is the major source. And when we compare it or contrast it with something like lead poisoning, which is found everywhere, including housing, that's actually quite appealing, because you could take fluoride out of the water just like that and get rid of the major source. So that's important. There are a host of other possible sources, including pesticides, particularly those used on grapes. So for children, for example, who eat a lot of raisins, that might be a concern. It can be used in anesthetics, in certain antidepressants. So it really can be found everywhere, but probably the most important is fluoride added to drinking water. Other drinks and foods made with fluoridated drinking water. And we're especially concerned about formula-fed infants, because infants will absorb fluoride more readily than older children and adults. And infants who are formula-fed, that's their primary source of nutrition. And if their formula is mixed with fluoridated tap water, they can have levels 3 to 4 times higher than adults drinking the same water, and up to 70 times higher than children who are breastfed, because breast milk contains very, very small amounts of fluoride.
So, Dr. Lanfear, let me just get this straight. We are exposed to fluoride through our water, and presumably through toothpaste and mouthwash and what the dentists do. But you went on to say pharmaceuticals.
Mm-hmm.
And you went on to say anesthetics. And you went on to say also pesticides. So it sounds like there are fluoride atoms every place in our environment. I mean, drugs like Prozac, fluoxetine, or Lipitor, atorvastatin, or Flonase, fluticasone, or levofloxacin, Levaquin, and you also mentioned anesthetics. So it sounds like we are exposed to fluoride in a lot of different ways on a regular basis.
That's right. And that may be part of the reason that fluorosis, discoloration or mottling of the teeth, has been increasing over the past 20 or 30 years. And that led to the U.S. Public Health Service lowering the recommended amount of fluoride added to drinking water. So we are probably getting much more fluoride than we were 50, 60 years ago.
I think a lot of people have no idea that they're being exposed to fluoride from all of these different sources. They probably heard about Teflon
and PFAS, which you'll have to help us understand what a PFAS is, because there are thousands of chemicals in our environment that are PFASs.
Yes. Yeah, and they're in particular in our drinking water, which is kind of ironic because that's what we're concerned about with fluoride. Now, we don't know that some of these interact or not, but one of our biggest concerns in environmental health these days is how the chemical cocktails or the chemical mixtures we're all exposed to interact with each other. So, for example, we've been looking at fluoride, but we found that boys whose mother had low iodine in their diet actually did worse than the boys who had higher exposure to fluoride, but sufficient iodine. Now, that would suggest that one possible mechanism about how fluoride results in IQ deficits is that it might do by disrupting the thyroid hormone. Fluoride and iodine compete for absorption into the thyroid gland. We also know that PFAS disrupts thyroid hormones. And so if you're exposed to PFAS chemicals, higher amounts because we're all exposed, but if you're exposed to higher amounts of PFAS chemicals and you're iodine deficient or pregnant or you have Hashimoto's antibodies, that also puts you at risk for hypothyroidism. In our MIREX study, we did a study, and there's only two studies out there like this, so more clearly needs to be done. In our MIREX study, we looked at fluoride in drinking water in the pregnant women. And we found that as fluoride levels increased, we saw significant increases in hypothyroidism in the moms. When we looked at the women and stratified whether they had Hashimoto's antibodies or not, we found almost threefold increased risk in hypothyroidism. And then when we looked to see whether it made a difference if the women had lived in the same house, drinking the same amounts of fluoride in their drinking water, the results increased yet again. So one of the most important potential mechanisms is thyroid disruption that not only might cause hypothyroidism, we need more evidence there, but also might help to explain why children do poorly when they're exposed to fluoride. The developing fetus is entirely dependent upon the mom's thyroid hormones in the first one or two trimesters.
Dr. Lanphier, you have been describing some of the problems associated with fluoride exposure, especially in newborns, but maybe even in women with regard to thyroid function. And I think that a lot of the fluoride enthusiasts and a lot of dentists who love fluoride will say, but the levels are so low, Dr. Lanphier, they couldn't possibly cause any problems, not in children, not in the fetus, and certainly not in the mom. Can you help us better understand this whole idea of the so-called dose response curve when it comes to toxicology and the possibility that even low levels over a lifetime might pose problems?
Yes, there's a few ways to think about it. I think one of the most important ways is to recognize that this idea that low levels of chemicals are safe or innocuous really sort of, it's an assumption. About 50 or 60 years ago, that assumption was made so as not to upset the economic order of things. We didn't have any evidence, and it was a reasonable assumption. But what we've learned over the past 50 or 60 years, and what I really woke up to when we studied low-level lead poisoning, is that not only are there no safe levels or thresholds, we actually see greater harms in some cases, or steeper increases in risks at the lowest measurable levels. We see that with lead and IQ deficits, lead and coronary heart disease deaths, asbestos and mesothelioma, benzene and leukemia, air pollution and death. So most of the widely disseminated and well-studied toxic chemicals exhibit no safe level or threshold. And in fact, the National Academy of Science in 2009 concluded that unless there is evidence of a threshold, the EPA should not assume that there is a threshold. So that really is one of the most important things, I think, in public health and toxicology today, because we're exposed to so many different chemicals.
We surely are. And as you've been describing, it's now, I think, very well accepted that lead is dangerous. Lead is really dangerous for babies and for the fetus. But that wasn't always an accepted fact. It took scientists quite a long time of studying lead exposure and its consequences to demonstrate that lead is dangerous. Why do you suppose fluoride is so controversial?
Well, I wonder if I could just step back a little bit, because I think lead is especially informative here in many different ways. And so if you go back 100 years, precisely, there was this big debate. There had already been massive poisoning of the workers in the plant that was making tetraethyl lead. That's lead that was added to gasoline. 5 died, and up to 80% of those workers were severely lead poisoned. The state of New Jersey and Philadelphia and New York City banned tetraethyl lead. The U.S. Surgeon General convened a panel of scientists and industry representatives to find out whether it was safe to add lead to gasoline. The scientists all said, no, absolutely not. We know lead is a poison. The industry representatives, Dr. Robert Kehoe in particular, said, wait, we know lead's a poison, but until you've proven lead's a poison at low concentrations that will be found in gasoline, you have no right to prohibit us from using it. So that set the stage for the past century. And you could argue that even all the way through my research, certainly, that the primary focus of the research we've done over the past century is to find out at what levels lead is toxic. And the problem is, the challenge was, that because we were so heavily exposed, we had to bring levels down in order to study children at lower and lower levels. So what about fluoride? Well, we're concerned about parts per billion of lead for children and adults. We're talking now today about fluoride in the parts per million. So we're already starting out with a very different level of exposure. With lead, back in the 1970s, we were exposed to levels 1,000 times higher than our pre-industrial ancestors. Now, blood lead levels have come down by over 95%, but we're still 10 to 100 times more heavily exposed today than our pre-industrial ancestors. What about fluoride? We don't have really good evidence about fluoride, but we don't really know on an evolutionary scale what low levels of fluoride are.
Dr. Lanphier, I'm curious how you feel about some of the aspects of fluoride that have not really been considered very much. And we've been talking about this as a potential neurotoxin, but it's also got antibacterial activity. In other words, one of the ways in which fluoride prevents cavities is that it presumably discourages the bacteria that would form those cavities. There have been questions raised more recently that this may be affecting our microbiome, not just the microbiome of the mouth, but maybe the microbiome of the digestive tract. And what are those consequences? Any thoughts?
Well, I don't study the microbiome, but I do think that anything that changes the microbiome deserves to be scrutinized, just like any drug. And I think that's one of the things that we've heard advocates talk about for quite some time. And I didn't really worry too much about that, but I do think that's probably one of the most important things to think about when we think about fluoride. First is, when you start adding something to the water, when you take away people's ability to choose whether to be exposed to something like fluoride, you must have really strong evidence that it's safe and beneficial. That was a central tenet of what Jeffrey Rose talked about. He said it's one thing to have fluoride in toothpaste, which, by the way, the studies show is quite efficacious based upon randomized controlled trials. What we're seeing now with new studies, Cochrane reviews, looking at the benefits of fluoridation, based upon studies done after 1975, which is when fluoride toothpaste became widespread, there may not be as much benefit as previous studies thought. So I think we really need to think about fluoridation from two different angles. One is it toxic? And number two, is it really as beneficial as we thought? And one of my concerns as I've gotten more involved with fluoride research is it's been clear for the past 50 years that water fluoridation has been the primary, maybe even the only way that we're thinking about population strategies to protect children from tooth decay. It's kept us from thinking about alternative risk factors like lead, for example. Lead may also be a risk factor for tooth decay. It's kept us from thinking about other possible solutions that might be safer.
So when you say lead might be a risk factor for tooth decay, you mean kids who are exposed to more lead might be more likely to have cavities?
Yes, that's what we found probably about 20 years ago and published it in JAMA. And then we have another study that found the same thing. Now, why is that? It's not entirely clear, but we found that as blood lead levels increased, we saw significant reductions in salivary flow rate. And salivary flow is critical for protecting us against tooth decay. We also saw increases in the particular type of bacteria in the mouth as blood lead levels increased. So we need to look at other possible risk factors. I mean, whatever fluoride in water is doing, still tooth decay is widespread, right? So whatever benefit it offers, if any, it's not solving the problem. We need to look for other ways to protect children from tooth decay.
You're listening to Dr. Bruce Lanphier. He is professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. Professor Lanphier's research at the intersection of preventive medicine, pediatrics, public health, toxicology, and infectious disease is driven by a commitment to prevent death, disease, and disability. He has studied the effects of lead exposure on children's health for decades. More recently, he's published research on the effects of early fluoride exposure on children's IQ.
After the break, we'll consider whether avoiding sugar might be effective against tooth decay.
What should we be doing to protect the youngest and most vulnerable members of society from fluoride-related harms?
Is there a synergy among risk factors that can make relatively low risks more dangerous?
What would the precautionary principle suggest?
How important is it to separate science from politics when it comes to water fluoridation?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements. Cocovia Memory Plus is formulated with 750 milligrams of cocoa flavanols, a level clinically proven to improve three different types of memory. More information at cocovia.com.
Today is the second of a two-part series on the pros and cons of water fluoridation. Last week, we heard from a dentist and epidemiologist about the benefits of fluoride against tooth decay. This week, we're looking at the other side of the coin.
We just heard that even low levels of a potentially toxic chemical are not necessarily safe. And because we're now exposed to a complex mixture of compounds, from per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, the safety of water fluoridation is more complicated than it was 50 years ago.
In the United States, many chemicals are considered safe until proven otherwise. That means we're exposed to a witch's brew of compounds that people in Europe may not encounter. They have a different philosophy called the precautionary principle. We'll learn more about that concept momentarily.
We're talking today with Dr. Bruce Lanphier, professor of health sciences at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. Professor Lanphier's research at the intersection of preventive medicine, pediatrics, public health, toxicology, and infectious disease is driven by a commitment to prevent death, disease, and disability. He's published over 350 peer-reviewed studies about the impact of toxic chemicals on intellectual deficits, behavioral problems, and brain structure in children. Bruce and his brother Bob co-founded Little Things Matter to make the science on toxic chemicals publicly accessible. They produce videos to show how human health is inextricably connected with exposures to toxic chemicals and to elevate efforts to prevent disease.
Well, you know, Dr. Lanphier, when I was young, and that was a long time ago, my dentist basically said, watch out for sugar. I was told, you know, sugar would cause cavities. And nowadays, you know, soft drinks are everywhere, and kids love ultra-processed foods, and they love sugar. And so the idea that, well, we can counteract sugar with fluoride probably was misplaced.
Well, not only misplaced, the sugar industry was creating misinformation even before the tobacco industry was. And we'll soon see a study that shows how we've been duped again by big industry. Fluoride, as you pointed out, in water has been used as a diversion to distract us from the problem of sugar. And you're absolutely right. Very little has been done as part of this national caries prevention program to address the problem of sugar intake.
So, Dr. Lanphier, what should we be doing to protect our youngest and possibly even our oldest and most vulnerable citizens when it comes to some of these chemicals? You obviously have thought a lot about lead. What's your thinking these days about fluoride?
Well, I think in the immediate term, we need to convene an independent scientific committee, most likely under the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, that is unbiased, and ask them to evaluate the evidence about the toxicity and potential benefits of fluoride in drinking water and fluoride as a whole, and come up with policy recommendations. Should the EPA lower the maximum contaminant level of fluoride in drinking water in the United States? Should fluoride continue to be added to drinking water? What about all these other sources we've been talking about, and pesticides, for example? That is absolutely urgent. And it's urgent because, number one, we already know that people who are for fluoridation are going to continue to promote fluoridation. That hasn't changed based upon all this evidence. And so we need to have that kind of independent, critical review. And I fear if we don't, the American public will become more distrustful of public health agencies. And we can't have that. We rely on public health agencies. We need to be able to trust the public health agencies, whether it's about fluoride or vaccines. So I think that's the most critical. I think we also need to provide this growing evidence to the public and let them make choices until policy decisions have been made. Now, when my two daughters were pregnant, I advised them to avoid fluoride. If they want to brush their teeth with fluoride, easy enough, spit it out. Now, we don't have fluoride in our drinking water in British Columbia. Actually, the vast majority of Europe doesn't either. So I absolutely recommended that they avoid fluoride during their pregnancy and, of course, with their children. If your children are going to use fluoride toothpaste, you need to work with them, brush their teeth with them so that they spit it out. They should not be swallowing it. And they should use just a rice-sized bit on their toothbrush, not the volumes that you see in toothpaste commercials who are, you know, that's basically they're trying to sell more toothpaste. So those are some of the most critical things. We will always, of course, need new research, and there will be studies. There are going to be new studies coming out in the next month or two. We'll always need more, and maybe that will change my mind. But at this point, I'm convinced that the evidence is sufficient because my bias is first do no harm.
So it looks as though that idea of having an independent, really objective panel evaluate and assess the evidence would be super helpful. And in the meantime, before we have new policy recommendations, do your best to avoid fluoride except in toothpaste where you're going to be able to spit it out. Does that kind of sum it up?
I think it does. I mean, we've talked about quite a few other drugs that contain fluoride. And, you know, each of those will need to be thought about both from the risk and benefit perspective. But I think it's one of those things where if you can avoid it, except for very specific reasons, and again, fluoride toothpaste, I think, is the most obvious.
Dr. Lanphier, we are exposed to, as you described it, a gamish of chemicals. There's so many in our environment. So it's not just fluoride. It's not just pesticides. It's not just anesthetics that are gases. It's not just pharmaceuticals that have fluoride in them. There's just, you know, thousands of PFAS chemicals. And the question is, does each one contribute just a little bit? And is there some kind of a synergy that's not good for us? Because all of these different chemicals working together, combining and interacting in other ways that we don't even understand could be adding to the problems. What do we do about this chemical brew?
Well, that's a much bigger question. But if we just focus on fluoride for a moment, I think the key thing is to recognize that while fluoride in drinking water, especially if you live in a fluoridated community, is the major source, it's not the only source. And so if we want to really get a good measure of what somebody or some population of people are exposed to, we need to have a biomarker. It's a biologic marker of exposure. And the one that's used most often is urine. That gives us a good estimate of the total exposure. Now, it's not perfect. The amount of fluoride in urine has a short half-life of about 6 hours, so it's variable. And so you'd like to have more than one urine measure, if at all possible. But we know that that's a good and valid way to measure it. We're also studying teeth and toenails as other biomarkers. And those are likely to be longer-term biomarkers, just like water fluoride may be a longer-term biomarker if people stay in the same community. But again, the problem is, even though that might separate you high versus low exposure, if you live in a fluoridated community versus not, it's not going to give you a very refined measure, and it's not going to give you the total exposure. The second question you brought up, how do we think about this cocktail of toxic chemicals we're all exposed to. Do they interact with each other? Well, we certainly have some great examples where we know that they do. We have some evidence, this is the first time it's been looked at, that boys who are exposed to higher amounts of fluoride and whose mothers have lower iodine appear to be at greater risk for IQ deficits than boys who are exposed to higher amounts of fluoride, but their mothers have adequate iodine. And that makes perfect sense. There's other studies that show, for example, that if children or pregnant women, are exposed to higher amounts of pesticides or phthalates in utero, and their mother is folate deficient or has insufficient amount of folate, they may be at greater risk for autism. So we know that these chemicals can interact in some ways, but for the thousands of chemicals out there, we know only about a couple handfuls. There's so little known about how these chemical mixtures impact our health.
Dr. Lamphere, what is the precautionary principle and why does it matter?
Yeah, the precautionary principle is really critical. I used a different way of saying that. First, do no harm, right? Now, that's something that we're trained in medicine to use. The precautionary principle really became prominent maybe 2 or 3 decades ago. And I think it's a really important concept, but boy, was it beaten up. The big industries came in and made it just really difficult to talk about the precautionary principle, at least in North America. But I think people do need to think about it from the standpoint of the way their physicians were trained, which is first, do no harm. And that basically means that we should assume, particularly chemicals or pollutants that we're all exposed to, might be harmful until we prove otherwise, especially when we have evidence like this meta-analysis that looks at all of the evidence and shows consistent decrements in IQ in both high and low quality studies, but especially in high quality studies. So now it's not just about this general idea that we should be careful. It's that we should absolutely pause and reassess water fluoridation because we've got this growing evidence and consistent evidence.
Dr. Lamphere, I'm wondering how dentists react to your research.
I don't know for the most part. I certainly have heard a lot about vocal minority. I've also had dentists who've asked me to come talk because they're concerned about fluoride. So there are some on both sides. I don't know if there's been a survey of dentists to see where the vast majority of them would fall, if asked. But I believe that most of them have been taught that fluoride is beneficial.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Dr. Lamphere, we are faced here in the U.S. with politics that you don't have to worry so much about in Canada. But as you may know, there have been a number of folks who have been very vocal in their anti-fluoride pronouncements. And the result is it has become politicized. And so rather than talking about necessarily the science, people have chosen sides based on politics. What's your thought about what's going on here in the U.S. when it comes to fluoride?
Well, I was initially concerned that fluoride and the science of fluoride toxicity was going to be politicized, but it has been for decades. I think the fact that it's getting so much attention, in part because of Robert Kennedy Jr. Bringing that attention into the light, I think is a good thing in the long term. And why? Because I think the more and more people look at the evidence, they'll realize that the evidence is sufficient to conclude that fluoride is toxic to the developing brain. And they'll look at this new evidence that says, since 1975, community water fluoridation doesn't appear to be as beneficial as it was in previous decades. So I think bringing more attention to it, having more people look at the evidence, is going to be important.
Dr. Bruce Lanfear, thank you so much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy today.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to Dr. Bruce Lanfear, Professor of Health Sciences at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. Professor Lanfear's research at the intersection of preventive medicine, pediatrics, public health, toxicology, and infectious disease is driven by a commitment to prevent death, disease, and disability. He's published over 350 peer-reviewed studies about the impact of toxic chemicals on intellectual deficits, behavioral problems, and brain structure in children. Bruce and his brother Bob co-founded Little Things Matter to make the science on toxic chemicals publicly accessible. They produce videos to show how human health is inextricably connected with exposures to toxic chemicals and to elevate efforts to prevent disease.
Water fluoridation is, all this time, still a controversial topic, and researchers have legitimate differences of opinion on it. What they will all agree on, Terry, is that more research is necessary. But what drives me a little crazy is that we've been fluoridating water since 1945.
It's a long time.
Yeah, more research is necessary.
But it is.
Gracious. Yes, it is. But shouldn't it have been done long before now? Well, I do want to add that last week we spoke with Dr. Gary Slade, dentist and epidemiologist. He's the John W. Stamm Distinguished Professor of Dentistry at the UNC Adams School of Dentistry in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show as well as last week's show. Al Wodarski engineered. Dave Graydon edits our interviews. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, with the People's Pharmacy.
The People's Pharmacy is made possible in part by Cocovia Dietary Supplements. Cocovia Cardio Health is offered in both convenient capsule and powder formats, with each serving containing 500 milligrams of cocoflavanols to support heart health. More information at cocovia.com.
Today's show is number 1418. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. That's where you can share your comments about today's interview. You can also reach us through email, radio@peoplespharmacy.com. We'd value your thoughts on water fluoridation.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider. You'll find the podcast on our website on Monday morning.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you can sign up for our free online newsletter to get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also have regular access to information about our weekly podcast, so you can find out ahead of time what topics we'll be covering. If you missed last week's show, you can still catch up with that perspective on water fluoridation. It was show 1417 and is available where you get your podcasts or at peoplespharmacy.com. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week.